at first, but we worked with the analysts, our private biologist partner, and some U.S. government labs to refine, refocus, and advance the collection requirements until we had a credible body of intelligence. Then analysts could assess threats and help us generate more requirements. From what looked like a dry riverbed sprang a trickle of reporting and operations. NR leveraged access to post-9/11 bulk data and the intelligence community's analytical capabilities to discern foreigners in the United States with possible links to known BW-related institutions abroad. Our NR team first used pattern analysis of foreign student visa data. There were obvious broad questions. Which individuals deviated from the norm in terms of arrival and departures for the new school term? Did someone enter the United States on a student visa and not report to school? Then, more specific inquiries. Which foreign graduate students had any affiliation with foreign universities or institutes with bioscience programs linked to BW programs? Which of these students had other anomalies in their backgrounds or had relationships with known foreign intelligence officers? Bingo. We connected one country's institute to a foreign student who was engaged in the study of toxins at a U.S. university. We found more foreign students with similar links to the institute. At this point, with a clear nexus of BW and counterintelligence suggesting a criminal threat of BW technology transfer, we brought in the FBI, which opened an investigation. I never learned what they found. Increased awareness also led to related intelligence. As an example, an NR station learned that a small group had purchased a high-technology system often used in labs that handle biological agents. This warranted more investigation, including link analysis of phone numbers and emails, which led to a known terrorist group. NR then passed the intelligence to CTC and the FBI for pursuit overseas. In the intelligence business, often there are only partial answers and limited or unknown results. An intelligence officer's professional challenge, among many others, is living with incomplete results. The painting is never finished. There is always something to add, something unknown, something that changes. This was especially true in our BW intelligence program. My initial hope that our BW intelligence collection would promote more robust U.S. government policies and more incentives for collection was mostly unfulfilled. Our trickle of reporting remained a trickle, but it did become self-sustaining, with feedback from customers and follow-up in certain areas, particularly related to AQ and their enduring effort to acquire BW. As I traveled around the United States, I learned more about NR's deep network in the private sector and the willingness of U.S. citizens to cooperate. Almost all wanted to listen to our requests, and the overwhelming majority would help, at least to some degree. We worked closely with corporate attorneys and our own legal team to cover all legal bases. This was especially important in telecommunications and data industries. In all these cases, but particularly where joint NR private sector operations extended abroad, we instituted strict tradecraft to protect the relationship. Many risked not just their reputation, but also the commercial interests of their companies. Many cooperative CEOs explained that their leadership responsibility, with the interest of their company foremost in mind, required them to help the CIA. They viewed their company's interest in safety and security as being in alignment with the safety and security of our nation. As one told me, "Yep, if our relationship became known, it would be a god-awful mess. I would have some investors and their lawyers up my ass for years. But it would be a lot worse if there is another 9/11 and my people die and I did nothing to stop it." Only one CEO ever refused to meet with me, citing fear for his own security. I wonder what he really thought. We would beat him with a rubber hose? We would sully his pristine reputation when we crossed his office threshold? A young officer, learning this, asked me, What do we do? We do nothing. It's a free country. But just imagine what life must be like for that guy, checking himself every morning to see if he still has a pair. In contrast, a CEO in Texas wanted to know if he could help us kill terrorists, and he meant personally kill them. I told him that we had other people doing that, but thanked him anyway. Nanotechnology. The private sector cooperation covered all parts of the United States, from Silicon Valley to Wall Street, from huge multinational companies to tiny enterprises, from staid conservative banks to wild liberal entrepreneurs. It ran the gamut from traditional industries that had been helping since the days of the OSS to new ventures harnessing new science. One of the best, most productive examples was nanotechnology. Advocates and critics had been debating the value of nanotechnology for years. Investors remained restrained, seeking more practical applications, but the long-term value seemed certain, according to the National Science Foundation and the smart scientists and entrepreneurs with whom we talked. Some projected a $1 trillion industry within 10 years. Nano means 1 billionth, and a nanometer is 1 billionth of a meter. Nanoscience is focused on molecular structures at that scale, the smallest structures that we can build. In material science, it does not get any smaller unless you are at the atomic level. This was not only about size, I learned, but also about changes in the characteristics of materials. At the nanoscale, materials behave differently. The molecules act differently, forming new bonds that also affect the material properties. The applications of this super-small, super-strange technology were vast. A DI analyst first introduced NR to this topic. Because it was complex and unknown to most of us, Donna took the lead. A brilliant student, she could absorb new data of all sorts and make sense of it. She had studied psychology and understood human nature and incentives, so she crafted our campaign to grab the attention of collectors. NR outlined examples of the way nanoscience was changing the nature of specific national security businesses, including espionage. For CIA ops officers in the field, a nanofabric impregnated with a virtually undetectable tracking device would present a direct and immediate threat to them and their operations. A CIA officer sporting a new jacket, handcrafted by his favorite Asian tailor, could be wearing a tracking device monitored by a hostile intelligence service. In such a case, all his counter-surveillance detection skills would be useless. A bunker fabricated with nanostructured materials could prevent the penetration of a warhead. For the SIGINT operator, nanomaterials used in communication systems could produce smaller devices with unique signal patterns, thereby preventing or obfuscating collection. By dynamically changing the acceleration and trajectory of a missile, nanostructured propellants could foil anti-ballistic missile systems, particularly those relying on impact. Nanofabrics capable of active camouflage, that is, changing colors and patterns to match the environment, will pose new challenges of identification and engagement. The Department of Defense was acutely aware of the advantages of nanotechnology. 3 years earlier, in 2002, it had created and funded the Institute for Soldier Nanotechnology at MIT. The mission focused on enhancing the survivability of the soldier on the battlefield. DOD had invested $50 million at the outset. But what were U.S. adversaries doing? What would be the impact on U.S. national security? What were the most important of these potential threats? These were the questions that NR needed to craft and answer. Donna and her network scrubbed the nanotech programs of select foreign countries, focusing on national security applications. NR identified foreign institutes, determined their vulnerabilities, and then developed operational scenarios. Then we scored. Working with CIA operatives abroad and an allied foreign service, NR developed and launched an operation. Eventually, our operatives acquired the first sample. An officer delivered the sample to my office. This was the material that had cost so much in man-hours and dollars. In my office, alone, with a big smile, almost laughing, I inspected the materials. Who would have thought this stuff would save DOD millions of dollars in research and development, maybe save U.S. lives? My NR deputy, who had served me well, departed after my first year for another assignment. I was able to convince Gina to be my new deputy. She had multiple overseas tours, serving as a chief of station in one especially challenging place. She had also honchoed an important office in CTC. But soon after her arrival, the new DDO, Jose Rodriguez, asked that she be bumped upstairs to serve as his chief of staff. I needed to find another deputy fast. I was sulking in Gina's office, asking her if she